This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Iraqis appear to have violated international law in showing dead American soldiers on TV and in the behavior of troops that pretended to surrender and then attacked American soldiers. President Bush has warned that Iraqis who mistreat POWs, take innocent life, or destroy infrastructure will be held to account as war criminals. But even the legitimacy of this war has been the subject of great international debate. What are the rules that are supposed to be regulating the behavior of the Iraqi army and the U.S. military? My guest Roy Gutman is the co-author of the book Crimes of War. He's a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and president of the Crimes of War Project at American University. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting in 1992 on atrocities and other human rights violations in Croatia and Bosnia. He was the first reporter to give lengthy accounts of mass murders in the prison camps of Bosnia. He wrote a book about covering the war in Bosnia called A Witness to Genocide. There have been photos of dead American soldiers, soldiers who look like they were executed, that have been shown on Iraqi TV and Al Jazeera. Still, photographs of this are circulating on the internet. What do the Geneva Conventions have to say about this kind of display?
Well, first of all, if they were executed after they were taken prisoner, that itself is a crime under the Geneva Conventions. And secondly, to display them in a way that degrades or humiliates them or affronts their dignity is itself another breach of the conventions, and the breach of the conventions is also known as a war crime.
So what kind of recourse do we have about this?
There hasn't really been much recourse over the decades since the 1949 Geneva Conventions. I mean, there were the Nuremberg tribunals, and there was in the 1990s a tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and for Rwanda. But on the whole, there's been no form of actually punishing somebody for a violation. Now, in this particular case, the United States has said it's going to hold trials and put those people who it suspects are responsible for crimes on trial. So there actually will be recourse. I'd say, though, in the more immediate sense, the real recourse is publicly embarrassing those who are responsible. So what the U.S. government has done, and I think it's the proper thing, is if there is what seems to be a violation, to talk about it publicly. And sometimes simply the spotlight of shame and embarrassment will force the other side to stop what seems to be a violation.
As a journalist, once these photos have been shown on Iraqi TV and on Al Jazeera, do you think it's appropriate or inappropriate for the American media to say, well, it's already made news, so we should show it? I mean, what should the American media do?
It's a tough judgment call for every news organization. And I think on the whole, people prefer, editors prefer to avoid causing undue pain, suffering to the families. That being said, if once they're in circulation, you know, they can find them on the internet, or they can might be able to find them on some satellite channel or other, and I'm not sure you can conceal these forever. It's just the nature of the world we live in right now that there is no such thing as a photo or a film clip that can be suppressed. So I think eventually editors do then make the films available to the public, but I can understand for the sake of the families why they would not. Now, there's another reason, frankly, for not showing films of people who were mutilated or executed, which is that it's going to lead to a very public and a very negative reaction, and it might bring political pressure. And, you know, photographs can have great motive force. And, of course, you can't really calculate that as an editor, but you do have to bear it in mind when you decide whether or not you're going to show a film or a clip.
Now, if American media showed these images, is it still a war crime to show it?
Well, it is. I think the crime is in the initially it is in the filming and the making available of that film on state TV, in this case Iraqi television. But you know, Terry, there's another side to the same coin, which is that as Iraqis have been arrested or have surrendered and have been taken captive. American television has shown them being captured, and I think that it's quite legitimate and reasonable as journalism to have their pictures, if they're just shot incidentally in the course of being captured or in the course of surrendering. But once television or newspapers or still photos start showing the faces so that the people can be identified, there is literal risk to that person's family, if you know, in the case of an Iraqi, because if they're surrendering, the government might very well be able to locate their families and start punishing them. It is simply for that reason that, you know, the general prohibition on taking pictures of captives, of surrendered prisoners, is a good one. And I think it makes sense for both sides. And the thing is, the American government should not be urging the Iraqis to observe the rules and then allowing the suspension of the rules for American reporters. It's got to apply in both directions.
Roy Guttman is my guest. He's a journalist and co-author of the book Crimes of War, which is about war crimes and the Geneva Conventions. Is Iraq a signatory to the Geneva Conventions?
It is. You know, nearly every country on earth is a party to the conventions. As I say, not just a signatory, but they've actually ratified them. And so, in fact, by doing that, it becomes part of your treaty law and it becomes part of your obligations. I think Iraq joined the conventions in around the mid-1950s.
What is Iraq's track record on treating prisoners of war?
Not very good at all. Frankly, if you go back to the first Gulf War, they took American prisoners. They did not allow the International Red Cross access to the prisoners, which is really vital for making sure that they stay alive and well. And in fact, tortured American prisoners and then showed some of them on television. It was really an appalling record. And of course, they took a large number of Kuwaiti prisoners as well, some of whom have never been accounted for. I think it's an abysmal record in all regards.
So you're worried about the American soldiers who are now being held as prisoner of war by Iraqis?
Oddly enough, less so, because I think the Iraqi track record has become a subject of many, many news reports and features and questions. And so and now, you know, with this global village that we live in, multiple full-time television news organizations who are constantly asking the question of the Iraqis and raising the question about how are the Iraqis going to treat prisoners. The Iraqis are under the spotlight, and so much so that when Tariq Aziz held a press conference the other day, I mean, he was asked, the top officials are repeatedly being asked, are you going to observe the Geneva Conventions? Are you going to treat people according to the rules? And they have really no choice but to say, yes, we will. So it's a slightly different picture than it was 10 years ago, and I have slightly more hope simply because the spotlight is shining and it's being focused by quite a few of our colleagues in the field.
There have been Iraqi soldiers who pretended to surrender to the American military, and then the Iraqis attacked the American troops they were surrendering to. What does international law have to say about that?
Well, very simply, that is a crime. The crime is if you pretend to be somebody you aren't, you know, and if you put on a UN uniform or if you put on an American uniform or something like that, it is regarded in the first instance as a clever trick or even a dirty trick, a ruse. They call it in military parlance. And if you attempt by doing that to fool the other side into an action that causes them harm, then that is known, it's a kind of an ancient term, as perfidy or perfidious use of symbols. If, however, if you then use that opportunity as a soldier or as a military unit to deceive the other side and cause them significant harm and certainly to kill them, then it is considered treachery. It is listed as a crime, and I don't really know if there's been too many cases brought before too many tribunals, because as I said earlier, haven't been very many tribunals since these laws were drafted. But it is a crime, and it is a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions and a war crime. And the party which perhaps takes control, as I assume the Americans and British will be in charge after this whole thing is over, have every right under international law to bring war crimes proceedings against anybody responsible for that sort of a breach.
Is the act of surrender supposed to be considered somewhat sacred so that surrender can exist without it always being suspect?
Well, precisely. The symbols are important under international law. I mean, it's also what makes international law sometimes a little bit dry and a little bit artificial because, you know, does everybody wear their rank insignia exactly where it's supposed to be? Is everybody always in uniform when they're fighting? We all know that's not the case. But surrender is one of those sacred events in a war, and it has to happen in every war. There's only going to be one winner on the whole for most wars. And if somebody holds up the white flag, it is a signal that they have decided to give up the fight, and therefore they become, under international law, they become protected persons of the detaining power. Once you start playing around with that symbol, you make it almost impossible for the next guy to surrender because the superior force is going to assume another ruse, another example of treachery, and they may start to shoot first and ask questions later. So a lot of innocent people can be killed. A lot of wasted lives result from this. And it's and for this reason, over the decades, over the centuries, it's become part of military custom and part of law that a surrender is has to be respected, has to be dealt with in a certain form, and not to do that is treachery.
We've also heard about Iraqi soldiers who were dressed as civilians and then opened fire on American troops. Is that also considered perfidy or treachery?
Well, that's slightly different. I mean, it depends precisely on the circumstances, but my understanding is that if you give up your uniform, and you're still bearing arms, you are no longer a legal combatant. You no longer have the right to use arms against the other military side, and therefore you become an illegal combatant, and to shoot as an illegal combatant is itself criminal. But we know that in so many wars, one side or other will decide to use what they call guerrilla tactics, and they will give up their uniforms and try to melt into the crowds and use the crowds as a kind of a shield. And using civilians as a human shield is itself a crime. And, you know, Terry, you can boil down this law to its essence, and it really amounts to this. You've got to avoid at all costs casualties among civilians, among non-combatants. They are protected people. And the second aspect is that soldiers are themselves legal combatants. They're allowed to kill the other side. But once they have surrendered, or they have taken ill, or they're wounded and captured, they are themselves protected persons. So those are the two major elements in the law. And violating these principles is a breach of the principles.
My guest is Roy Guttman, co-author of the book Crimes of War and president of the Crimes of War Project at American University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Roy Guttman. He's co-author of the book Crimes of War, What the Public Should Know. He's also a journalist and president of the Crimes of War Project at American University. We're all afraid that American troops will face chemical weapons when they enter Baghdad. We know that Iraq used chemical weapons in the Iran-Iraq War. Was Iraq ever brought up for violation of the Geneva Conventions for using chemical weapons?
The unfortunate fact of life of the Iran-Iraq war and most wars is that until very recently, there was no place, no neutral location, no UN body, for example, that could actually investigate, prosecute, and and conduct trials and then incarcerate the responsible people. Right now, there is an international criminal court that could operate in such a situation, but it didn't exist when that war was going on. The second interesting element, if you think back to that period, and you know, if you recall, this was a war that got very little coverage in the American and the international press, very little focus. And one of the reasons is that the U.S. government's attitude in the Iran-Iraq war was that the fear was that Iraq, having started the war and having mounted incursions into Iranian territory and then being thrown back by the Iranians, that Iraq might lose. And as a result, the U.S. government was willing to countenance, to close its eyes to quite a few violations by the Iraqis, among them the use of chemical weapons. The U.S. government may have formally taken exception to what the Iraqis were doing, but in a very private way, in a clandestine way, they were actually assisting the Iraqis because the CIA was providing data to the Iraqis to indicate how well the chemical shells were being targeted. So the U.S. government, which is in a sense the, you know, not just the strongest on earth, but also the one that tends to set the rules for international life, by virtue of assisting the Iraqis indirectly and really hoping for their victory, no matter what means they were using, the U.S. government, in a sense, compromised the high ground and basically in no way tried to stop or punish the Iraqis, and they got away with it.
Let's talk a little bit about the United States' behavior in this war with Iraq. The first, quote, target of opportunity that we had was a bunker that the U.S. military believed was housing Saddam Hussein. Is it legal under the International Code of War, the Geneva Conventions, is it legal to target a head of state?
Well, the head of state is the top of the chain of command, in fact, and in Iraq and nearly anywhere else, therefore becomes part of the chain of command and is a legitimate target. In practice, you go back to World War II, governments tend not to target the head of state because they know then that they're going to have, a huge effort to defend their own head of state, and it's sort of been unwritten code that they don't do that.
Is there a U.S. order banning assassination, and would that order apply in wartime?
Well, of course, you're absolutely right. But that is a peacetime order. If you're at war, the man who's the head of state or, you know, at the top of the chain of command is a legitimate target, and so those orders about assassinations in peacetime do not apply.
Now, the Bush administration is calling this a war of liberation in Iraq, but not everyone in Iraq agrees. Is there a body of law that determines what a just war is?
Well, it's really a branch of political philosophy or theology, and it goes back to the Middle Ages in this sense. Roman Catholic theologians devised a set of rules for what is a just war. And among other things, there has to be a legitimate government which declares the war. There has to be what they call a just cause. The use of force has to be proportional. The resort to force has to be the last resort. The aim of the war has to be peace. There has to be a reasonable hope of success. Now, these are the criteria that have existed throughout the ages. Since the creation of the United Nations, the term just war has sort of gone into abeyance, and the the more used term, more frequent term, is legitimate use of force. And essentially, this comes down to whether a war is declared, and it comes under the provisions of the UN Charter. You know, the UN Charter allows every state the right of self-defense, but it also brings in collective defense and collective security. And so, this is sort of at the essence of this debate about that's going on in the Security Council throughout March, whether the U.S. Was threatening to use force legitimately. The argument on the one side of nearly everybody else on the Security Council, except for three or four U.S. allies, was that the Security Council had to approve yet another resolution. The U.S. Administration and others said, like Britain, that no, there are sufficient resolutions. So it's a bit of a debate, and I don't think that one can give a crystal clear answer. But if you had what Jefferson called a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, I think you would say that the Americans operated without full support of the world community and are operating in a somewhat unilateral way, and that that the claim that this is a just war is definitely disputed and controversial.
Roy Gutman is the co-author of the book Crimes of War and president of American University's Crimes of War Project. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Roy Gutman. We're talking about the international rules of war, which should be regulating the behavior of the Iraqi and American military. Roy Gutman is the co-author of the book Crimes of War. He's the president of the Crimes of War Project at American University and a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the concentration camps in Bosnia. During the so-called shock and awe campaign, the U.S. military has dropped an extraordinary number of bombs on Iraq, though the military says that these are very precisely targeted bombs, and in most cases it seems, from what we know, that the bombs have in fact hit their targets. What are the conventions surrounding what is considered an appropriate target of war?
Well, a legitimate military target is one that is used exclusively for military purposes. It can be an object, a building. It can be weapons or a system, and it can be the individuals who are operating those systems or who are part of that military establishment. So there's a lot of clarity on what is a military target. It's also there's a lot of clarity about what is a civilian object or target, and that is not a legitimate target. The problem is, Terry, that you have gray zone cases. You have many dual use kinds of facilities. You know bridges, tunnels, roads, many buildings, power plants, dams, and it's not always easy to distinguish whether this is primarily a military or a non-military target. And so this is where the real debate occurs on whether a particular target is a pure military target. The other thing that confuses and complicates the picture is that militaries often will take a civilian target. It might be like a school. I remember in Kosovo when the Serb army moved into the schools in the center of several towns in Kosovo, and making it very difficult. I think that I recall the town of Uroševac, and I heard this from people in the town, that the army moved into the school and used it and turned it into a barracks. Now, of course, a school is not a military target, and yet if it is taken over by a military force for military purposes, then it becomes a legitimate target. And probably the object in taking over the school was that if the U.S. Bombed the school, the Serbs would come out and say, "You see, they're committing a crime because they're bombing a school." So that is a very tough issue for every military, and on the whole, they tend to, certainly the U.S. Military tends to try to avoid that sort of attack at all costs. You know, it's another thing just to point out, though, is that the U.S. military takes enormous efforts to ensure that the targets it attacks are legitimate and that they are limited and that collateral damage will be minimized. They take efforts that the public doesn't really know about, but it involves having lawyers. And in fact, taking, you know, once the target is selected by the target selection committee, it goes to the lawyers. And the lawyers look at both the, you know, the location, the surroundings, the kind of weapon or explosive that's going to be used, the angle it's going to be attacked from, and they study this. They do computer simulations to try to determine whether the target is legitimate, whether the target is limited enough, whether there's enough precision that collateral unnecessary, let's say, civilian damage will be can be avoided.
President Bush has said to Iraqi generals that they should, quote, clearly understand that if they take innocent life, if they destroy infrastructure, they will be held to account as war criminals. Now, to a lot of Iraqis, it's the United States that's coming in and destroying life and destroying infrastructure, no matter how unintended it is on the U.S. military's part to actually destroy infrastructure and take the lives of civilians. Do you have any reflections on that?
I think the American side may be overstating its case when they accuse the Iraqis of or potential war crimes in attempting to destroy their infrastructure. It is a completely legitimate act of war to destroy infrastructure if you think that's going to be in the supreme interest of your self-defense. So if they blow up bridges, even to some degree, I don't know how oil wells come into this, but I think that's what the Americans have mostly in mind. If the Iraqis booby trap and set oil wells on fire, well, there might be some military argument for even doing that. What there is not a military argument for doing is destroying, burning, torching oil wells when the intention is to, in a sense, destroy the environment and create a scorched earth for the next regime. That is a environmental war crime, by the way, which has never been prosecuted in any tribunal that I know of. But in general, the defending force does have the right to destroy or to blow up bridges as it evacuates an area so that the other side cannot follow it.
My guest is Roy Guttman, the co-author of the book Crimes of War and the president of the Crimes of War Project at American University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Roy Guttman. He's a journalist. He's co-author of the book Crimes of War, What the Public Should Know. And he's also a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and president of the Crimes of War Project at American University. In thinking about crimes of war and writing about crimes of war, you've actually been critical of the United States' treatment of detainees at Guantanamo, detainees from the war on terrorism. What are your criticisms about the people that the United States has been holding as prisoner?
When the U.S. decided it had to go to war in Afghanistan, I think under international law and certainly the mood of the world opinion was that it was a completely legitimate and just cause. And obviously, when you have overwhelming force and you're fighting against an opponent who has at most primitive means of defense, you're going to win and you're going to capture a lot of prisoners. And that's exactly what happened. The U.S., in taking the prisoners, broke precedent in a way. The administration decided that they were not combatants. In fact, every person they detained, they decided either was a illegal combatant or was in some ways or an unlawful combatant. They had different terms. And they have 600 or 700 detainees right now at Guantanamo in Cuba. Ordinarily, in wartime, the Geneva Conventions are the rules that everybody quotes from. And the conventions allow you to hold a prisoner for a fairly long time, as long as the war goes on. But they do have some requirements on you, and the requirements include that you've got to be sure that you actually have a legitimate combatant, that you're holding a real fighter in your prisoner of war camps. The U.S. government decided to suspend the rules, basically, and by calling everybody an unlawful combatant, they said the Geneva Convention rules do not apply. So nobody of the 650 detainees in Guantanamo basically has combatant status. They're not being treated as they're supposed to be under the conventions. And the real problem there is that I believe, and I've done research on this with Newsweek, that they're holding a lot of people there who never fought, who are not terrorists, who are not actually a threat to them, and who have no way of proving this because there is no law under which they have any rights or any procedure for claiming that they're not combatants. They're being held indefinitely without any rules and without any protections. And I think it's egregious. I think this is a citizen, but I don't know of a single expert anywhere who thinks, in fact, that this is legal or proper, and it sets completely the wrong precedent.
If the United States wants to bring Iraq to court on charges of violations of the Code of War, violations of the Geneva Conventions, would the place be the International Criminal Court?
Well, this administration has decided that the International Criminal Court is anathema, and they have mounted a worldwide campaign to try to weaken and even cripple the court. So I would be rather surprised if the ICC, which is just beginning to set itself up, they've just elected the judges, I don't think they even have a prosecutor yet, whether the ICC would be brought into this. I think it's more likely that there are other forms that justice can take. For example, we've had the Yugoslavia and Rwanda tribunals in the set up in the 1990s, which are ad hoc UN Security Council organized tribunals with judges from many countries, and they've worked very well. And I think the U.S. government, the administration, would be willing to countenance that kind of a tribunal. A second possibility is a U.S. Led military commission, with probably the British and maybe the Australians taking part. Sort of thing we saw after World War II at Nuremberg. And the third possibility is to have an Iraqi tribunal, maybe with international participation, possibly on the order of what's going on right now in Sierra Leone, possibly some new kind of tribunal.
What are America's objections to the International Criminal Court?
The argument is, I've found it rather hard to understand, frankly, but they basically say, look, the United States has a far greater responsibility and role than anybody else in keeping the international peace. Its troops are going to be involved in a lot more places. It's likelier to become the target of a UN panel, looking for cases to bring up, because there's a tendency in the UN, and this is also true, as you know, to say, well, one from column A and one from column B. The case, I think it's really, when you come down to it, I think it's really ideological. I think there's simply an attitude in this administration that we're the United States, we're the most powerful country, this is an issue of sovereignty, we don't give up any of our sovereignty to anybody else. Just as they have, backed out of the ABM treaty with Russia, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, they have quit the Kyoto Protocols on climate warming, and other international treaties. I think that that is really the context in which they have decided to oppose and to fight the International Criminal Court. It's a big mistake, it seems to me, in many ways, because the International Criminal Court could deal with so many cases of wars that go on between, you know, small countries in faraway locations where the war crimes are horrific, and could actually try to bring some reason and some law and some order and some focus on those wars, which in a sense helps the U.S. And its own security and avoiding go to all those places. And so I think that there's a very short-sighted attitude by the administration, but they are determined and they are fighting very hard to limit the court in any way they can.
You covered the war in Bosnia for Newsday and won a Pulitzer Prize for your coverage.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Was it your coverage of Bosnia that led to your interest in and your research into the subject of crimes of war?
Very much, but not exclusively. I'm a foreign affairs reporter, and I've wound up, however, covering not just diplomacy and treaty negotiations, but wars are part of the foreign affairs scene. And I guess the thing in the Balkan Wars that disturbed me the most was that I, as a reporter, came upon stories of what seemed to be total abuses of noncombatants. And this, however, was not viewed by most people as a news story. I mean, my editors came along with me and agreed that eventually that some of the things I was writing about, concentration camps, systematic rape, the destruction of the culture, that these were really horrific things and also news. And I started to think about that fact, that crime in a domestic sense is news. Crime in an international sense, we don't usually, during wars, we don't usually define it as news, and yet it is pure news. The problem is for reporters that we are sometimes the only people on the battlefield who don't know what the rules of war are. Very few reporters nowadays have gone through military service, and almost nobody, if you ask colleagues in the field, will be able to tell you very much about what's in the Geneva Conventions until you're in the middle of a thing where you have prisoners of war. And so it struck me that it might be useful for us as reporters to know what the rules of war are. It's not just the Geneva Conventions, it's also the Genocide Convention and the various crimes that were defined at the Nuremberg Tribunal. And to know what military practice is. I mean, we should know the difference between what is legal in war, what is illegal, and what is criminal. And if we know those distinctions, we might be able actually to spot news stories sooner, real stories, stories of things that shouldn't be happening. What sometimes happens is that this can embarrass the country involved or the government involved that's responsible, embarrass them before the international public to the point that everybody starts asking them questions, and it becomes so embarrassing that they cannot carry on with that crime.
Did that happen to you after any of your reporting?
Well, in a sense, it did. I reported, it's a bit over 10 years ago, about the concentration camps in northern Bosnia that the Bosnian Serbs had set up. One of them, Omarska, was a place where they were killing people at the rate of 50 to 100 to 200 a day. I found people who had been in Omarska, for some reason had been released. They talked about that camp and a second camp in the town called Birchko. And very factually, I couldn't even use their names, but I could show their pictures. I then got every kind of backup I could to the facts that I was collecting. That's to say, the International Red Cross had something to say, the European Union, the American Embassy, and other people said they thought that this might be true, and wrote the story. And the result of that story was that the camp, Omarska in this case, closed down within 2 days, and people were freed. And I think that that is kind of the model that, I mean, you know, this happens once in a journalistic career that you write a story that actually has that kind of impact. But I think in general, putting the spotlight on violations is not only a good news story, but it also sometimes might affect the crime that's going on and might cause people to take notice and maybe even stop doing what they're doing.
My guest is Roy Gottman. He's the co-author of the book Crimes of War and the president of the Crimes of War Project at American University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Roy Gottman, co-author of the book Crimes of War. He's a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. What do you think of the Pentagon's embedding of reporters? Do you think that's a good thing both for the information that we're getting at home, and also do you think that might possibly help in preventing war crimes or in shaming people responsible for them?
Embedding is such a new concept that we'll have to see how it works. But my initial reaction is that it's a very positive contribution both to news reporting and in the field of preventing war crimes. It really might be a real impetus. I don't really have great worries about the American forces. I think they're well-trained. I think they know that they've got to answer, that they are accountable at the end of the day for what they do, and they have to live with themselves, and that's just the nature of our open society. But nevertheless, I think it's a good idea for reporters to be along, and everybody's going to have to be on their best behavior. And, it's quite possible that reporters who are embedded, there are some 500 of them, don't have our little book along, and they may not have an idea of what the rules of war are. But a lot of it's intuitive. A lot of it's just common sense. And you sort of, if there's a violation, you sort of smell it. You feel it. You have some sense of it. And you start asking questions. And then somebody might, dredge out what the rule is under the Geneva Conventions. And so everybody in the American military officer corps is aware that they're going to be questioned on that. All these things now are questions, and I think that embedding it might be the best thing that's ever happened to international humanitarian law.
How do you feel about it as a viewer, as a spectator? I think for a lot of us, it's so odd because it's gripping to watch it, but it almost makes you feel like this bizarre kind of voyeur sitting comfortably in your kitchen or in your living room or your office, watching people risking their lives on the battlefield. And then also there's the sense that I think a lot of us are feeling like, how can we possibly go on with daily life as we bear witness to this on the television?
Well, don't forget there's a trend in American television now to have reality shows.
I know, and that's adding to this feeling of well, my fear is that reality television risks almost cheapening the grave reality of what we're seeing in the war.
I mean, last night on one NBC channel, they had bathing beauties diving into tanks full of dead fish. And in another one, they have a reporter in Nasiriya describing the ambush of the day and the number of people who were killed. And I tend to think that I prefer the war channel myself, but other people may have another choice. I think people have a hard time. We all have a hard time with real reality. I can tell you, when a war is going on, especially if atrocities and crimes are going on the whole, the public doesn't want to know about it because on the whole, people probably feel psychologically there's nothing I can do about it. And this is really just too awful for words. And I'll flip the channel. And so they watch a so-called reality show, which is totally fictitious and coming up with horrific punishments for everybody who's taking part in it. I think I find one of the problems in watching the news as it's coming out of these embedded journalists is confusing. Because you have a little slice of life from one location and you have no slice from 11 other locations. You have a hard time putting things together in providing an overview. And I think television has not, the editors and presenters have not yet quite figured out how to sum up and how to, paint both the broad context and relate that to the specific item that is just coming in, from their man on the scene. And I think that's a matter of adjusting, and so it's rather confusing at first. But that being said, I think some of the television reporting and also the newspaper reporting is really as good as it gets. It's obviously, if you're embedded with a unit, you have a very limited view, and yet you do see real things. You can't give the broad context, but you can describe a real slice of life. And so long as that is somehow presented in context, I think the viewer is going to have a much better grip on the reality and the horror of war. I mean, those of us who were, everybody was quite impressed by the first day's advances. But then by day two or day three, you had ambushes, you had the fragging of three tents full of military officers. In Camp Pennsylvania, you had Marines, losing their vehicle in the swamp, taking a wrong turn. This is what war is all about, and it's not a pretty picture.
Well, Roy Guttman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Nice to be here.
Roy Guttman is the co-author of the book Crimes of War. He's president of the Crimes of War Project at American University.